From Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International, it's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming.
Just as our army is the best army in the world, same with this story. We're talking here about an opening so innovative that it's protected by registered patent. And where is this patent registered? That's the thing. It's registered in the story itself. This story's got no shtick to it, no trick to it, no touchy-feely bits. It's forged from a single block, an amalgam of deep insights and aluminum. It won't rust, it won't bust, but it may wander. It's super contemporary and timelessly literary. Let history be the judge. And by the way, according to many fine folk, judgment's been passed, and our story came up aces.
That's an excerpt from the audiobook version of a short story by Edgar Carret called The Story Victorious. We'll meet Carret in just a moment as we explore innovative fiction in this hour. Also, comic novelist Mark Lehner on his hyperkinetic, psychedelic new novel, The Sugar-Frosted Nutsack. And we'll visit two surreal literary universes. One features an unorthodox solution for sexual harassment in the office, and the other includes a full-scale replica of Manhattan built in Puget Sound. Also, the never-before-told story of the girl who went on the road with Jack Kerouac and Neil Cassidy. But first, Edgar Carret. Carret was born in Tel Aviv in 1967. His short stories have often been described as Kafkaesque, though, as a fellow writer has pointed out, they're probably best described as Carretesque. Carret's new short story collection is called Suddenly a Knock on the Door. He tells Steve Paulson that he started writing after a traumatic event that occurred while he was serving in the Israeli army.
My best friend, who served with me in the same base, became heavily depressed, and he shot himself. He killed himself. I found him after he shot himself.
Wow. Do you know why? I mean, depression, obviously, but was there something about serving in the military, do you think?
I think that whenever somebody kills himself, we look for this kind of exclusive reason, because it makes people feel safe. Because let's say, if I would say, yeah, it was because he was in the military, and so you can say, okay, I'm not in the military, I'm safe, you know. If I would say it's because his girlfriend left him, you'd say, oh, my girlfriend didn't leave me, I'm safe, you know. But I think there was something very existential in that suicide, and that what was so threatening about it. Because, you know, if there's somebody you really love and you're really close to and he kills himself, then you say, so actually, why don't I do the same thing? And I think that when I started writing, it was basically a way of putting it on paper, saying, this is why I want to live. This is what life means to me.
Now, the story that I've heard about your friend's suicide is even more complicated for you. Apparently, shortly before he did this, he asked you to give him reasons for why he shouldn't kill himself. And if you couldn't come up with a reason, he said he was going to do it.
Yeah, it didn't happen like the same day, but we had a few talks about the fact that he wanted to kill himself. And whenever he would mention it, I say, don't do it. And I would say, you know, we're all going to miss you. You're going to break my heart. You're going to break your entire family's heart, you know. And he said, you know, I'm sorry, but this isn't a good enough reason to keep on living. And he said, give me a good reason, you know. And these are the kind of things that are tough to articulate. You know, it's something personal. It's these kind of things that you can't put in words. But sometimes you can put them in the shape of a story, you know, because I think story many times is a way of kind of saying those things that you can't put out in one sentence, because it can carry all those ambiguity and complexity of a statement like, why am I living, you know?
So did that incident actually cause you to become a writer?
I wrote my first story a couple of weeks after he committed his suicide. I don't know, maybe I would have started writing anyway, but my life was going to an entirely different direction. I was serving in a computer unit. I was a math major. I was supposed to learn math and computers. And, you know, I never wrote anything in my life before that. So I don't know, maybe if you wouldn't have done it, today I would be some computer engineer or do something else. I'm not sure.
Hmm. And it's worth pointing out that the subject of suicide is a recurring theme in your fiction. You wrote a novella dealing with the subject, which was the basis of the film Wrist Cutters, a love story, and the subject of suicide comes up in your new collection of short stories, Suddenly a Knock on the Door. Does this all go back to your friend's suicide, or is there something else that draws you to this subject?
Well, I think that suicide is always a very strong metaphor for many things, but mostly for talking about life as a choice. I think that many times when you live your life, you know, and you think that, I don't know, things are not working, everything sucks, and you say, why is it happening to me, you know? And there is this sentence, you know, born never asked. I think many people kind of can live their life in a very grumpy and unhappy kind of way. But the moment that you internalize that your life is a choice, you could take your own life in every given minute, then it means that if you leave them and if you chose to leave them, then you should take responsibility of them and kind of live a life worth living.
Well, and one story in particular deals with suicide in your new book. It's called Not Completely Alone. Can you tell me about that story?
Well, it's a story told by a person who's in love with a woman who's not sexually attracted to him. And he keeps saying, you know, he keeps kind of seeing the relationship as a tragedy because she would have liked it to be a romantic one. But basically, she's very, very close to him, yet has sex with other men. And in the story, apparently she had known other people before that who killed themselves because of her. And at some point, the narrator keeps telling the story, but he killed himself because of her, and he keeps telling that story even after his death.
Four of the guys she dated tried to commit suicide. Two even succeeded. And they were the ones she cared about most. They were close to her, very close, like real brothers. Sometimes when she's home alone, she can actually feel us, Kuti and me, in the living room with her, looking at her. And when that happens, it's scary, but it makes her happy too, because she knows she's not completely alone.
Your stories are rooted in reality, but you have all these kinds of fantastical elements in them. You know, there's one story with a talking goldfish, another, there's a small zipper under a man's tongue that his girlfriend unzips to discover that there's an entirely different man underneath. There's a kind of dreamlike logic in a lot of these stories, which I suppose we would call surrealism. And you have been often called a surrealist writer. Do you think that label fits you?
It fits me to some extent, but I think that you can use surrealism in many different ways. Many people talk about magic realism when you kind of break realism to get this feeling of uplift and optimism and that feeling of beauty that comes from the fantastic. But I don't think that's the case in my stories. I think that there is something very mundane about the unrealistic things in my stories. But many times they're just kind of a way or a path to talk about something that is actually very simple and very everyday-like. But I kind of take a detour and do it through some sort of a fantastical situation. But, you know, I'm saying sometimes my character needs somebody to tell him that he's wrong. And sometimes in my stories it would be a goldfish that would tell him that and not his mother. But that's purely circumstantial.
Is it a way to get at something that's more real, do you think, by bringing in these fantastical elements?
Oh, yeah, for sure. I think that there is something about realistic art that is kind of overrated. I think it's a perfectly legitimate choice, and I love a lot of literature that is realistic. But I think that when you write something that is completely subjective. You know, it doesn't matter even if you write in a third-person narrative. You write what you feel. And sometimes the stuff that you feel is not realistic. And my commitment is to truth. It's not to the laws of physics, you know. So if I want to follow some sort of an inner truth and it will take me in a route that is fantastical, I'll happily take that route. It's not a goal, you know. It's just a mean to get somewhere.
Edgar Carret is the author of Suddenly, A Knock on the Door. He spoke with Steve Paulson. Helen DeWitt's new novel, Lightning Rods, was shortlisted for the Believer magazine's Book Award. The editors described it as a really funny and really serious book about contemporary America's certainty that sex is so important and that business is so important. The novel's protagonist is a down-and-out salesman named Joe. He spends most of his time fantasizing about women. One afternoon, a particularly strange fantasy leads to a life-changing epiphany, as Helen DeWitt tells Anne Strangechamps.
You can sell all kinds of things if you bring sex into it, if you suggest somehow that somebody can get sex as a result of acquiring the product. And yet, selling the thing itself is stigmatized. It's such an incentive for people, and yet you can't sell it directly.
So you can sell pornography, but you can't sell prostitutes.
Yeah, or it's stigmatized. So it's kind of hidden away. He's sort of thinking about that, and he's thinking about sexual harassment and these huge sexual harassment suits and how very successful individuals are suddenly penalized. You know, there was some guy who apparently dropped M&Ms into a woman's blouse by the Xerox machine and then fumbled around in her blouse. Then the company had to pay out $1 million or so for a sexual harassment suit that went against them. So he's just thinking about all this and thinking, you know, there has to be money in it. And, you know, if you could sell anonymity along with sex, this would just take off. He suddenly thinks, what if that would work? Of course, you know, he realizes it's going to be hard to sell, but he thinks, you know, sales is a numbers game. And all you need to start off with is one person to buy it.
He comes up with the idea of it's a contraption. So how would you describe it?
His idea is because he's adapting his fantasy. I think that's why this somewhat implausible solution comes to him. It's that you could have a contraption where the disabled toilets in the men and women's bathrooms are back to back. And you can have this contraption so that the woman is placed on this contraption and then goes sort of ass backwards through the wall. A panel opens, she goes in. He's computerized this so that male individuals on the staff will be notified at random when they have the opportunity to participate in this. The hypothesis is that the women are anonymous. These are members of staff. They fulfill some role in the company. So they are paid a normal salary, and then they are paid twice that to function as lightning rods as well.
These women are, you call them lightning rods, hence
yes.
The title of the, why that term, lightning rods?
Well, I think his idea was that this deflects the lightning of inappropriate desire in the office. You know, he is very blinkered. He is not thinking about women having desires and whether women might need some kind of outlet. He is not thinking about whether there might be gays on the staff. I mean, he has this extremely, it's not just heteronormative. His assumption is that it's men with a high sex drive who are the high performers. I mean, this is his little assumption.
And of course, this entire thing is tongue-in-cheek. We're talking about it seriously. And Joe, your character, takes it completely seriously.
Yes.
But the entire plot, of course, is completely tongue-in-cheek. So I was going to ask you to read a little bit, and I thought maybe this section, just to kind of give us an idea of how this works for an ordinary working guy.
Okay. Roy is the human resources manager of the firm, and he's somewhat obese, so he goes to the disabled toilet when he needs to go. And so he has now gone into the disabled toilet in the men's room. Roy was about to pull himself to his feet when he heard a funny kind of click. A panel had slid open in the wall beside him. Roy stared. In the hole revealed by the panel were the soles of two bare feet pointing downward. While he watched, some kind of mechanism must have been operating, because gradually the feet moved out into the room. Bare calves came into view. Bare thighs, bare... Holy mackerel! He was looking at the naked lower portion of a woman. The mechanism had stopped. He couldn't see anything above the waist. As it was, he could see plenty, and then some. I don't believe I'm seeing this, he thought. This wasn't some casual sexual liaison among the staff. Someone had had to build this contraption and put a hole in the wall. How many people were involved? What would the shareholders think? Was it even legal? Nothing happened. I gotta get out of here, thought Roy. He stood up, did up his pants, and buckled his belt. He flushed the toilet. The naked rear end of the woman hadn't moved. Jesus, thought Roy had never had a girlfriend, and though he had been on a couple of dates when he was younger and thinner, he had always been shy. This kind of thing was way out of his league. I'm getting too old for this job, he thought. Roy had had to deal with a couple of unsavory incidents in his time, but what the dickens was he supposed to do about this? Who would he even tell? What was he supposed to say? He tried to imagine telling someone, Steve Jackson, for example, about the naked lower portion of a woman. I just can't do it, he thought. A man from the younger generation would probably have taken something like this in his stride. Roy just couldn't deal with it. He couldn't even think of words he could bring himself to speak in the presence of another person. But how could he just walk away from it? It would be irresponsible to bury his head in the sand and pretend it hadn't happened. But what the hell was he supposed to do?
Poor Roy. We have not discussed the women, the lightning rods themselves, because, as we said, you take this insane proposition, you play it all the way out in the book. So Joe builds his contraption, and then there are women who, it turns out, are willing to be employed as lightning rods. Can you tell us about them?
The way Joe decides to sell this to possible applicants, you know, he puts ads in the paper for just normal positions, and then people show up, and then he explains that there's this other aspect to the job, but that they will be paid twice the going rate, and that it's for a real team player and somebody who wants to make a contribution to the firm. And then he'll say, he knew one gal who wanted to go to Harvard Law School, and she realized that, you know, with the extra money she was making through lightning rods, she could pay her tuition. He's just making these things up. But then one woman comes in and he says this, and, you know, she was a creme de la creme secretary, and she's just thinking, you know, is this all I want out of life? You know, maybe I could just go to Harvard Law School and apply her abilities to something that really merited them.
Maybe we could hear from Renee, the woman herself.
Okay. Renee prepared for the new job the way she prepared for everything, thoroughly. The way Renee looked at it was this. You were selling use of your body for short periods of time in exchange for the chance to make the best possible use of your mind. Well, why not take it one step further? Why not set aside the actual time allocated for non-secretarial functions and put it to use? Learn a language, study accounting. Do something with the time so that at the end of the year, say, you'd look back and what you'd see was that you'd worked on a language a couple of times a day. On top of being paid for the time, you'd have a new asset that no one could take away from you. She spent quite a lot of time thinking about which particular project would give her a real sense of achievement. What she finally decided was that this was the ideal opportunity to read Proust's masterpiece, À la recherche du temps perdu, in French. The amount of time lightning rods were typically expected to be on duty would be just right for working through a French text. On the one hand, she wouldn't be reading a lot at any one time, so she wouldn't get discouraged. On the other hand, it was quite a long book, so by the time she finished, she'd probably have enough money for Harvard Law School. She could look at the volumes on her shelf and see how far she had to go. So she went to the university bookstore and bought the complete set, and she started at page one, paragraph one, on her first day on the job. Sure enough, the idea worked perfectly. The idea that she had to struggle with the French meant she didn't have a lot of attention to spare for anything else that might be going on. She'd go through as much text as she could, underlining words she didn't know with a pencil. At night, she'd look up the words and read through the passage again. The next day, she'd read on. Within a month, she was having to look up fewer words. Within 6 months, she was reading the French almost as well as she read English. And that was entirely the result of doing it on a daily basis.
And then, of course, your next paragraph tells her that Renee not only finishes reading Proust, she eventually does wind up at Harvard Law School and, in fact, a Supreme Court justice, all of which she credits to her time spent as a lightning rod.
Exactly.
Helen DeWitt is the author of Lightning Rods. She spoke with Anne Strainchamps. Have you read any good innovative fiction lately? You can let us know through our website at ttbook.org. You'll also find links to our Facebook page and our Twitter account there. It's always nice to hear from you. Coming up, one of America's premier satirical novelists, Mark Lehner, and the story of Lou Ann Henderson, the woman who started Jack Kerouac and Neil Cassidy on their journey on the road. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. William Gibson says that to read Mark Lehner's The Sugar-Frosted Nutsack is to have it etched on your brain with a sharp periodontal tool. Publishers Weekly says it may indeed be the craziest book ever written. So what is this mind-bending, hallucinatory vortex of a novel all about? Who better to tell us than the author of The Sugar-Frosted Nutsack himself, Mark Lehner?
There is a man. He's an unemployed butcher. His name is Ike Carton. He lives in Jersey City, New Jersey. And Ike believes, rightly or wrongly, I don't want to have to issue a spoiler alert here, but Ike believes that there is a pantheon of gods that determine what happens to mortals. There's some question raised in the book about whether these gods only exist in Ike's mind. There's also a kind of metaphysical proof, a kind of very logical proof posited by someone that the fact that they may exist only in Ike's mind proves their existence. So there are all kinds of conversations about that. But really, in terms of what happens in the book, Ike goes to a diner and gets a tongue sandwich and flirts with the waitress, comes back, and then hangs out with his daughter's boyfriend, whose name is Vance, and basically waits to be killed. Ike has a kind of, I shouldn't say a fear, in a way it's a hope, because Ike thinks that it's his destiny to be killed in front of his family and his neighbors, killed by Mossad sharpshooters. The great passion of Ike is really to bring that destiny upon himself as quickly as possible.
I think that's actually a fairly concise reduction of the story that you're telling.
It's very much the story, and not only is it the story, it's a story I reveal at the beginning of the book and repeat and elaborate throughout the book, as myths can be. One of the things I realized when I started this book is that there's no suspense about myths. We all know the endings to them. I thought that there's something kind of wonderful about that because it really confounds such a standard convention of novels, which is reading in order to know what happens. In this book, we know what happens, and I'm constantly, in case you don't get it the first time, you know.
You're making sure we know by the end.
I remind you, yes, ad nauseum, what happens.
Near the beginning of the book where, as you say, you state much of this. Page 5, I wonder if you would read that long paragraph on that page. It ends on the top of page 6.
Okay. These drunken gods had been driven by bus to a place they did not recognize. It's almost as if they'd been on some sort of spring break, as if they'd gone wild. At first, they were like frozen aphids. They were so out of it, as if in a state of suspended animation. It took them several more million years just to come to sort of thaw out. The first god to emerge momentarily from the bus was called El Brazo, the arm, also known as Das Unheimlichste des Amheimlichen, the strangest of the strange. He was bare-chested and wore white Columbia blue polyester dazzle basketball shorts. He would soon be worshipped as the god of virility, the god of urology, the god of pornography, etc. El Brazo leaned out of the bus and struck a contrapposto pose. His head turned away from the torso, an image endlessly reproduced in paintings, sculptures, temple carvings, coins, maritime flags, postage stamps, movie studio logos, souvenir snow globes, takeout coffee cups, playing cards, cigarette packs, condom wrappers, etc. His pomaded hair swept back into a frothy nape of curls like the wake of a speedboat. He reconnoitered the void with an impassive take-it-or-leave-it gaze, then scowled dyspeptically, immediately turned around and returned to the bus, where he suddenly ensconced himself, along with the rest of the gods, for another 1.6 million years. It's extraordinary that among these sulking, hungover deities who chose to forever doze and fidget in a bus, there were several with enough joie de vivre to continue beatboxing that hypnotic riff for an eternity, that music that's been so persistently likened to a dance mix of the Mr. Softy jingle. Perhaps it was a fragment of their alma mater's fight song. They did act, after all, like classmates, as if they'd grown up together in the same small town.
That was very nicely done, thank you. And I think that does give us a very clear idea of at least how one page of the sugar-frosted nutsack goes. These gods are, if they only exist in Ike's head, there's a lot of fascinating imagination in his head, isn't there?
Well, yes, I was going to say thank you, but you're praising Ike's head, not mine, which I like even better.
Yeah.
When I originally started toying around with this idea of gods and goddesses, I very much, adamantly, did not want to do anything that was like a parody of Greek gods and goddesses or Norse gods or Hindu gods. I wanted to create a completely unprecedented group of gods and goddesses. So I think that procedure had some pretty interesting results and consequences.
Yeah. Well, we've met El Brazzo in the reading that you did. Tell me about, do you say XOXO, one of the central gods?
Yes. I have to say, I'm particularly proud of XOXO as a character. I would say he may be the surpassing creation of mine over all these years, because XOXO, in a way, represents the nemesis of all writers. I think in the book I originally talk about XOXO as the god of head trauma and concussions and amnesia. But then I distill XOXO's function down to really being the great opponent, the great enemy of the epic. XOXO changes the epic. In a sense, I have to battle XOXO to complete this book. And XOXO is a mischievous god and puts things in the book that I didn't intend to be in the book, takes things out that I wanted in the book. As I was creating this character, I realized it's the most brilliant thing a writer could have, because I can simply blame anything on XOXO. if someone says, I love the book, but I didn't like this part, I'd say, well, of course not. That's an interpolation of XOXOs. I had nothing to do with that. I agree with you.
This may explain why sometimes I felt as though you were writing, I hesitate to say this, but I will, you were writing whatever came into your head.
I've heard that before. If that's what results, it's the most tortured stream of consciousness in the history of streams or consciousness. It's a very meticulous, workmanlike procedure, almost grimly so, to end up with this result. One of the things I wanted this book to have is a kind of subjectivity of its own. It's almost as if the book is the mind creating itself, and you can watch. It's like one of those machines without any membrane over it, so you can see all its inner workings. I think it's very easy to, as you're reading this book, see how the book is almost creating itself from page to page. There's a kind of transparency about it in that way that I like very much.
You've also said somewhere that you think of the world as a cryptogram. Is that true? What do you mean by that, if it's true?
I really love thinking of the world as rampant with sort of signs.
Clues?
Clues and symbols and signs that wait to be interpreted. I think the world exists as a kind of source of exegesis. I was reading some book maybe a year or two ago, and it had to do with, I think, the Sicilian Cosa Nostra. And there was a prosecutor in this case. He said the loveliest thing, which is that it is the vocation of a gentleman to interpret signs. It certainly is my vocation to create a world that is sizzling and pulsing with signs to be interpreted. Mm-hmm. That's not a bad description of what I'm trying to do.
Mark Lehner is the author of The Sugar-Frosted Nutsack.
That music that's been so persistently likened to a dance mix of the Mr. Softy jingle.
Here comes Mr. Softy. Yes, everyone comes a-running for Mr. Softy delicious soft ice cream. That's Mr. Softy.
You've probably read the book. Soon you'll be able to see the movie, finally. Although Jack Kerouac's groundbreaking novel On the Road was published in 1957, it's taken 55 years for it to make its way to the big screen. Beat historian Gerald Nicosia helped some of the actors prepare for the movie version of On the Road. He's the co-author of One and Only, the untold story of On the Road, which includes a little-known character, Lou Ann Henderson. She was 15 when she met 19-year-old Neil Cassady in Denver back in 1945. They got married and moved to New York, where they started hanging out with a group of young writers, including Jack Kerouac and Allen Ginsberg. A guy named Al Hinkle was part of the group, too, one of Neil Cassady's best friends. Gerald Nicosia and Al Hinkle tell Steve Paulson about the pivotal role Lou Ann Henderson played in making the Beat Generation possible.
A lot of people don't realize that Jack and Neil were very, very different at the beginning. You know, we're so used to seeing the pictures of them now with their arms around each other, and everywhere there's the icon of Jack and Neil, Jack and Neil. But Jack Kerouac was, as I say, a good French-Canadian Catholic mama's boy from Lowell, Massachusetts. He was totally bought into the system. His parents had given him this drive to go to Columbia. They had no money, but he got to Columbia on a football scholarship. Get ahead in the world, Jack. Make something of yourself. And, of course, he had the whole morality from the Catholic upbringing. Neil Cassady was not bought into the system at all. Neil grew up on Skid Row in Denver. His mother was not even around. His father was a wino, a derelict. He had to fend for himself from 5 years old, stealing the change off of newsboxes. By the time Neil was 12, he was stealing cars and taking women up to the mountains for sex, or 13 years old. And then he was in and out of reformatories. And at one point, he was in a reformatory that was almost like a penitentiary. So Neil had no investment in the system. They knew that they were very different. They were physically alike. I mean, they were strong, athletic, handsome. As Jack said it on the road, we tiptoed around each other warily because they didn't know if they could trust each other. But Lou Ann saw into the heart of both of them. She would tell Neil, you know, Jack is more than a Catholic mama's boy. He has great thoughts and profound thoughts about life. He wants to experience life. And she'd tell Jack, well, Neil is not just a jail kid from Denver. He read Nietzsche and Proust when he was in the reformatory. He also wants to make something of himself. So she was able to interest them in each other and begin to understand the depth in each other to the point where they could get close enough to become friends. And without that friendship, we wouldn't have had the Beat Generation.
I sure agree with that.
Yeah. Well, Al, you knew these people very well.
The decision to go to New York was made in my apartment.
Oh.
Neil was having an affair with another girl. And Lou Ann came to my apartment when Neil and this other girl were in my apartment and was quite upset about it because Neil had promised that he would have no more Jeannie, was her name, no more Jeannie. Lou Ann said, if we don't leave this day for New York, I'm leaving you. Mm. And I think that's the thing that pushed Neil into going, because the weather wasn't good. In fact, it really kind of sleeted when I drove him out to the edge of town where they could start hitchhiking.
Wow.
Jerry, how would you describe the personal dynamics between these early seminal Beat figures, especially Kerouac and Cassady and Allen Ginsberg?
It's an interesting three-way in a way. I mean, Ginsberg was gay, somewhat in the closet, although by the time Neil came to New York in 1946, Allen was starting to emerge from the closet, starting to admit at least to close friends that he was gay. He was looking for a male lover. We need to say that both men and women fell in love with Neil instantly. If you had any bisexual gay tendencies, you would fall in love with Neil, and likewise, women fell in love with him. He was handsome. He was full of energy. He was dynamic. And he could talk beautifully about anything. So Neil, when he met Allen fell in love with him. And this was a problem in a way because Jack, who we later found was bisexual, but was not, you know, he was not involved with Neil. Jack was looking for material. He wants to be a writer, but you got to have something to write about. You don't get it living at home with mom. And here's this guy that's been in and out of penitentiaries, prisons, stolen cars, tons of women, been all over the country. Jack immediately saw, wow, this is somebody I could write about. This guy's got the adventures. Neil wanted to be a writer. So there was an interesting dynamic there where they kind of envied each other because Neil saw that Jack had the patience, and Jack was bright and had gone to Columbia University. He had the patience, the training to sit down and be a writer. Neil wished he could do that. He was never able to do that. He was always moving so fast he couldn't sit down at a typewriter. So Neil envied Jack. Jack envied Neil, because Jack had no way with women at all. Neil was honored that Jack wrote about him. But it sort of froze Neil in time because Neil wanted to go on beyond that. Neil had dreams of going to college, becoming a writer, doing other things with his life. But suddenly he was set like in a photograph. He was held in that moment, the young car thief, wild man, womanizer. And people expected Neil to live up to that role called Dean Moriarty in On the Road. Meanwhile, you had Ginsberg, who was jealous that Jack was getting so much of Neil's time. And then Ginsberg and Neil formed a close bond, and Jack became somewhat jealous of that bond. And, of course, Luann is in the midst of it all, and she becomes both Jack's lover as well as Neil's lover. I want Al to talk about this. One of the things we talked about, Al, when I was interviewing you like a year or two ago, was the fact that, because you were very close to Luann, also when you were both young. And
yes.
You said Luann met with you, and she at one point she was saying, like, I know this guy is going to keep having other women, and I'm not sure, what do I do about it? Do I accept it? I mean, she was troubled by the fact that he had so many women, but she also loved him, right?
Right, yeah. It got to the point where she just kind of accepted her place in the storyline, you might say.
Hmm.
Well, and in fact, in some of the famous road trips that then later became part of On the Road, they had actually divorced by this point, right? But then Neil would swing by and pick her up. And, I mean, they were still sexually involved as they were taking these road trips, even though Neil had gone off and married another woman. In fact, had children with the other woman.
Had three children with Carolyn.
And they were sexually involved to the very end of Neil's life. And you can relate that because you helped bring them together in those days, a secret rendezvous, right? In the 60s?
Oh, yes. Like 57, when Jack's book was published, I drove out and picked Luann up, picked Neil up from the depot because he'd just come in from a passenger run down at San Luis Obispo. And the three of us went over to Berkeley and busted in on Jack just as he was opening the package of his
author's copies of On the Road.
Yeah. And the funny thing about it, he tried to hide them from us. And then Neil spotted them and grabbed one. And Neil really started off reading from chapter to chapter and jumping up and down and really getting all high.
Why did Jack try to hide the books that were telling the story of all of you?
He says, you're going to hate me. You're not going to like what I had to write. And then we had to spend 5 minutes telling Jack how much we loved him. Mm. Regardless of what he might have said or didn't say. We were just so happy for Jack.
Mm-hmm. Can I say something here?
Yeah, sure, go ahead.
What I want to say is about why he was so afraid of letting them see the book. In On the Road, he basically says that when he and Luann were left alone together, they were abandoned by Neil in San Francisco, and they were staying together briefly in a hotel. And then he says, in the book, Jack says, you know, I chose to leave her because she was a whore. She went off running off with other men for money. I saw her in a car with a sailor. This, you know, of course, really angered Luann. But the interesting thing she told me in this long interview that I print in the book, she said the real thing was that, we stayed in a hotel together after Neil abandoned us. We had no money. But I wanted Jack to, like, go out and get a job, get us an apartment, Jack. She was a teenage girl, and he was already, like, 26, 27 years old. She expected him to take charge. And she said every night he lay in bed in my arm and he cried. He was like a baby. He really was incapable of going out and getting a job and getting an apartment, setting up a place for himself and Luann to live. But he couldn't tell that. He couldn't tell that in the book. He never tells in the book that he lay in her arms and he cried like a baby. He changed it to, oh, she ran off with this guy she was whoring.
Mm-hmm. Let me ask you about some of the road trips that Kerouac, of course, immortalized in On the Road. Did you all take these trips basically just to get to your final destination, or was it partly to see America as well?
For me, it was to see more of America. And to fulfill a promise that I'd promised Neil we were going to, when we got laid off, we were going to go to New York.
And was this the trip in December of 1949 you're talking about?
December of 48 and January 49.
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah. What, you had gotten a new car, but there was no heater?
Well, yes. That was a kind of an amazing thing. Everything was on automobiles was extra.
Didn't you tell me you wanted to get the radio instead of the heater? Wasn't that the deal?
Oh, we had to have the radio, regardless of what that cost.
So you were, what, blaring music as you were going, but freezing in the process?
That's about it. But tell you about, you know, what a trooper Luann is, you know. When I was driving, and she's actually scraping ice off the inside of the windshield, and they're there in Nebraska one time. So we can look out, and I didn't have any gloves, and my hands are freezing. And she takes one hand and puts it down her pants between her legs to warm my hand up. Absolutely non-sexual friend move. She warmed my hand up, and then I warmed up the other hand. I'd just go through hell for that woman if it was necessary, because she would do this for me.
Al Hinkle is the author of the booklet Last Man Standing, which chronicles his adventures with Jack Kerouac and Neil Cassidy. Gerald Nicosia is the co-author, along with Anne-Marie Santos, of One and Only, The Untold Story of On the Road. You can find links to Hinkle and Nicosia's websites on our website at ttbook.org. You'll also find links to our Facebook page and Twitter account there. More than 50 years after its original publication, Jack Kerouac's On the Road continues to resonate with young people. Why do you think that's the case? And how well do you think On the Road will work as a film? You can share your thoughts with us via Facebook, Twitter, or our website. Coming up, we'll meet the man behind the novel that makes both 1984 and the Book of Revelation seem like yesterday's news. It's what Tom Robbins says as we conclude our hour on innovative fiction. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. Cormac McCarthy put his stamp on post-apocalyptic fiction with his landmark novel, The Road. Thanks to him, most of us imagine the world after the apocalypse as a desert wasteland with a few survivors wandering around, trying to survive on roots and berries. Ryan Boudinot decided to take a different approach with his contribution to post-apocalyptic literature, his novel Blueprints of the Afterlife.
Blueprints of the Afterlife takes place over two periods in history, one in the future, which is a period that happens after a series of cataclysmic events that are so horrible and apocalyptic that no one really understands what exactly happened. And so the survivors of that period, people who came out the other side of it, are all sort of standing around scratching their heads, trying to determine what it is exactly that went down. And the other period is more or less contemporary time, starting in the early 90s, and it's in the form of a Q&A interview with this guy named Luke Piper, who grew up in the Pacific Northwest, where a lot of the novel in both time periods takes place. The action of the novel sort of coalesces around a recreation of Manhattan that's being built on Bainbridge Island, which is in Puget Sound, which is about a half-hour ferry ride from Seattle. Over the course of the novel, the characters sort of convene on this island and learn more about just what's going on in their world.
You've come up with some pretty wild ideas, but they're based on things we know. I mean, talking about the bionet, it's extraordinary, but when you place it in the context of the internet, I guess it makes sense.
I've known people who have studied medicine or naturopathic medicine or different medical traditions, and I've looked around at the ways Eastern cultures look at the body in medicine, and it's different. It's a different modality than Western medicine. And I thought about what I know about digital information technology, and I kind of combined those two things and thought, well, you know, the next phase might be that we are able to download things from sort of an internet into our bodies, and that we're able to overcome illnesses by downloading an immunity that someone else developed in their body.
Yeah, I mean, it sounds kind of utopian on the surface, but when you get into it, you can see that there are aspects of it that have some problems. I mean, they're good. There are other good things. Some of the characters in the novel seem to have the ability to offload bad memories, for instance.
Like with any technology, the bionet in this novel has a number of people who abuse it. So there are people called DJs who basically take over other people's physiological systems and hack them. You can opt into this. You can choose to be DJ'd, and you basically become sort of an avatar of yourself in a way. There are individuals in the book, one in particular, who does offload his bad memories. With the bionet, longevity has been extended, so there are people who live to 200 years. And this one character named Skinner went through a lot of the horrible cataclysmic events that precede the novel. And so in order to be sane and to survive, he's had to offload a lot of his memories. But he's sort of obsessed with finding out what it is that he forgot.
You can see that when the rest of the world doesn't know what happened, and he knows that he once knew, it would be kind of terrifying.
Yeah, he lives sort of burdened by these memories and haunted and unable to really move forward until he's processed them. And there's other people who've gone beyond them and they've offloaded their memories and they're fine. They're perfectly happy living in ignorance of what it is they experienced in the past. But for some reason, he's sort of obsessed and he wants to return again and again to these events in order to uncover the truth of what happened in his life.
Is that also why, in part, the full-scale replica of Manhattan is being built in Puget Sound? I mean, in a way, it sounds like trying to rebuild the past in a different place.
Right. And one of the things that happens with this replica of Puget Sound is that there are people who are drawn to it, who show up on its shores and enter this new Manhattan. What happens to them when they get there is they start having dreams and start adopting the identities of people who lived in the real Manhattan over a century before. And so they start dreaming that they're someone else who lived in Greenwich Village, say, and they start becoming the people that lived in Manhattan before it was destroyed in some sort of ambiguous event.
Well, part of what appealed to me about that idea is that you created this city and then peopled it. And in a sense, you have that same thing happening again in the novel, this kind of outside-inside stuff going on, and the people acquiring other people's memories as though they lived in the original Manhattan. You're almost making fun of yourself doing that.
I suppose so, yeah. When I was writing that part in the novel, I knew that I had to have the characters show up in Manhattan. I couldn't just mention it offhand early in the novel and then not use such a cool setting. I had this thing sort of off to the side that people would refer to, but you didn't really get a glimpse of it until, say, the last 100 pages of the book. And so when I got to that part at the end, as I was writing it, the thing that I didn't anticipate was the whole notion of people taking on other people's identities, which fit in to some of the other themes that were going through the novel, particularly as they relate to a character named Abby Fogg, who has this strange feeling that she's not herself throughout the book, and she's sort of struggling to understand her identity, and she doesn't exactly feel like she belongs in this era or this world.
I wonder if you would read a little bit. There's a point at which she says that, when you say of her that. There's a section on page 70 about Abby Fogg. If you'd read that, that would be great.
Sure. So this is the first chapter in which she appears. So this is her introduction. Ever since childhood, Abby Fogg had wondered why she was herself instead of somebody else. She'd lie on her bedroom floor staring at the circle within a circle within a circle of the ceiling light fixture, freaking herself out with the fact that she was Abby Fogg. And while this Abby Fogg accumulated thoughts and memories, went to college, fell in love with archival films and a man named Rocco Patrone, the suspicion persisted that there had been some mistake, that somehow Abby Fogg had been dropped into the wrong body. Since the age of 5 or 6, Abby had suspected she'd been born in the wrong era, aching as she watched the grain of early 20th century footage. But the previous century wouldn't have her, with its artist salons and movie palaces and celebrity sex tapes. Nope, Abby had been born into this era yet to be named, and the years that followed that dark period known as the fuss. Nowadays, Abby rose early to make breakfast and spy on her neighbors from the Vancouver condo she shared with Rocco. Even though the place had a view of Granville Island, she preferred to sit in her undies in the dining nook, where she could read the news and glance through horizontal blinds angled at the precise diagonality to allow her a view into a condo across the courtyard and 3 stories down. The occupants of this condo are about the same age as Abby and Rocco, maybe a little older, not yet sinking into their 30s. The couple bore the same demographic characteristics as Abby's parents, she Asian, him sort of Latino-ish Caucasian. The woman usually rose first around 6:30 a.m., mounted a green football in her panties and tank top, drank coffee from an ugly brown mug, caught up on email. The guy rose about half an hour later, shirtless, a landing strip of chest hair marking his sternum. He shuffled into the living room workspace, scratching himself through plaid pajama bottoms, planted a kiss on his girlfriend's neck, and performed a few push-ups and stomach crunches on the rug. The woman worked at home, doing something design-related. The man left around 8:30 for a job that didn't require him to wear a tie, but sometimes he wore a collared shirt and a sport coat with jeans. Abby suspected these were days in which the man met with clients, whoever they might be.
I'm a little curious about your influences. Dave Eggers described you as some kind of new and dangerous cross between Kurt Vonnegut and Donald Barthelme. Have you read Kurt Vonnegut and Donald Barthelme?
Yeah, I have. I've read both those authors. Kurt Vonnegut, the first book I read by him was Galapagos. I remember reading it maybe when I was 13 or 14 years old. I remember that by like 100 pages in, I was completely offended by his tone, not in terms of the subject matter, but that he was doing things like saying, I'm going to put an asterisk next to the name of every character who's going to die in the next 50 pages. And I remember thinking, you can't do that. But then by the end of the book, I was so won over. I thought, that is brilliant. I love that.
Ryan Boudinot is the author of Blueprints of the Afterlife. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. You can stream To the Best of Our Knowledge on our website at ttbook.org, where you'll also find a link to the weekly podcast. You can buy a copy of the program by calling the radio store at 1-800-747-7444. Ask for the program Innovative Fiction. To the Best of Our Knowledge is produced at Wisconsin Public Radio. This hour was produced by Doug Gordon, with help from Anne Strainchamps, Charles Monroe Kane, Sarah Nix, and Veronica Rickert. Special thanks to special guest engineer Brittany DeAnda and to DJ Softy, Joe Hartke. Our executive producer is Steve Paulson. Our technical director is Kirill Owen.
PRI, Public Radio International.